after his arrest. He was charged with entering the occupied territories unlawfully and photographing military facilities without authorization. He was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment. The sentence included the year he spent in pretrial detention. When he heard of his sentence, he said, "I felt like I wanted to cry, but I didn't want to break down in front of Israeli regime authorities." During the trial, Hatem was kept in Nafha prison. The conditions there were a little better than in Ascalon. He said, "I found people to speak with. I could cut my hair and take a shower after spending 53 days without bathing." Many other prisoners who he met had been handed sentences of 20 or 30 years. Knowing that his own sentence was shorter eased things slightly. Hatem was held in Eshel, a prison in the city of Beersheba, but later transferred to Ketziot, which is located in the Negev region. He was not given any reason for the transfer. He said, "Your name suddenly comes up for transfer. They move you on a whim. You've built up friendships and suddenly you are with new people. They didn't like seeing us happy." Hatem found ways of defying his jailers. Using smuggled mobile phones, he applied to sit the Taujihi, an exam taken before going to university. The Zionist regime does not allow textbooks into prisons. To challenge that ban, Hatem had a school book smuggled to him. The book's covers and initial 10 pages were altered so that the prison authorities would think that they belong to the categories of permitted reading material. Many other prisoners also sat the exams. As the number of textbooks were available, they developed a system whereby each prisoner would have a book for a week and then hand it over to others. Exam papers are also not allowed, so one prisoner would have to communicate with a particular school, find out the exam questions, and then circulate them among other prisoners. Being able to overcome obstacles created a sense of camaraderie among the prisoners. When Hatem learned he had passed the exam, an impromptu party ensued. Hearing prisoners break into song, the prison authorities demanded to know why so much noise was coming from the cells. Hatem said, "They didn't like seeing us happy." Hatem's mother, Feiga, sought permission via the International Committee of the Red Cross to visit him on numerous occasions. All her requests were turned down. First, the Zionist regime cited security as a pretext. Later, it invoked restrictions introduced amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Following the death of his father in 2015, Hatem's bonds with his mother became increasingly strong. Feiga said, "Hatem was my right-hand man. When he was imprisoned, I felt like I had lost him." The early stages of Hatem's detention were especially difficult. With almost no information available to her, Feiga was uncertain that he was alive until he called her one day with a mobile phone smuggled into prison. Eventually, Hatem was released in May this year. Feiga said, "I shed tears of joy when I could hug him again. The feeling was indescribable." Now aged 28, Hatem is trying to rebuild his life. He has just become engaged. Numerous photographers and reporters were attacked during the Great March of Return by the Zionist regime forces. The Zionist regime killed two photojournalists, Yasser Mortaja and Ahmad Abu Hussein, while they were covering those protests. 9 other media workers were wounded. The Zionist regime's attacks on the press have continued since then. Such attacks caught the attention of the world's media last year when Israeli regime forces killed Shirin Abu Akleh, a journalist with Al Jazeera, in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. While Abu Akleh's killing prompted expressions of concern, so far toothless, from the United States, where she held citizenship, and the European Union, most violence against Palestinian media workers elicits no response from powerful governments. Hatem Abu Sharia is among many whose plight has been ignored. Al Jazeera English had earlier reported that the Committee to Protect Journalists, CPJ, says in a damning new report that Israeli regime military has taken no accountability for its killings of at least 20 journalists, 18 of whom were Palestinian, over the past 20 years. The Press Freedom Watchdog said it had found a pattern of the killings of journalists by Israeli regime military in its report, Deadly Pattern, published recently. It added, no one has ever been charged or held accountable for these deaths, severely undermining the freedom of the press. The CPJ said Palestinians make up 80% of journalists and media workers killed by Israeli regime military. The report said those figures are partly a reflection of broader trends in the Israeli-Palestinian case. Over the last 15 years, 21 times more Palestinians have been killed.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady. You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
She is a hurricane. She is a ray of light. She blooms wild and shines bright. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. Welcome back to your own program. This is Asma at your service as the host. And then we have Sister Zainab, the Islamic researcher, who is always helping us with too many interesting topics to talk about. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Alaikum assalam.
So, welcome to the studio.
Thank you so much.
So, just at the very beginning of today's episode, tell me. Well, I have to say it just right in here. She, Sister Zainab, is the one who writes many poems regarding women, And also Ashura, she writes beautiful poems. So as a literary woman yourself, tell me, how many women and how many, just let me just rephrase it and put it in this way. You have seen different characteristics, different images of women in literature.
Right.
Tell us about them.
Well, you know, women's portrayal in the poems and literature has varied throughout the history. It's not been the same. Like in the ancient times, you would have seen the poems and the literature where often the women were treated as the second-class citizens.
Yeah.
Or sometimes even objects of desire, or, you know, the source of inspiration for some male poets. And sometimes even submissive, even in the movies, even
exactly.
in the literature, even in the poems. So there are many poems where women are treated as objects by male poets and writers, and they, you know, take her as kind of inspiration of, like, you know, someone. She's very submissive in the old literature.
Well, I would say that even in literature, in English literature, we have it that they were just such a secondary creatures to men that when she started to write as a writer, she started to write with the pen name of a man because she knew that if she had her own name, she would have never got enough audience to read her books.
Right. You know, there are some examples of the poems, like there's this To His Coy Mistress by Andrew
yeah.
Marvel, where he uses flattery, he used threats,
mm-hmm.
and he used hyperbole to, you know, treat her as a passive object of his lust and does not care about the feelings and opinions of a woman. Then there's this The Flea by John Donne.
Yeah, The Flea.
Where the speaker treats his beloved as a reluctant object of his, you know, seduction and
mm-hmm.
manipulates her logic and
yeah.
guilt. There's another poem, She Walks in Beauty by Lord Byron, where the speaker praises a woman's beauty but does not mention anything else about her personality, character, or mind. She's just a spectacle and a source of aesthetic pleasure. That's what happens in most of the poems. That's what happens for male
yeah.
poets. Less is talked about her mental capability.
Exactly.
Very less
this is what happens in usually classic poetry. They look at women as if she's a doll and she's
not
a beautiful thing.
Exactly. I'm just not talking about the contemporary or modern poetry. I'm just
yeah.
talking about how woman was portrayed in the literature in
exactly.
the ancient times.
Yeah.
But now the things have changed.
Yeah, so I guess we'd better keep it for after the break. Let's go for a short interval and then we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
This is Muslim Lady. Welcome back to your own program. Well, as in today's episode, we're talking about women in literature and how they've been portrayed and viewed. And then according to what Sister Zainab said, women in the ancient time, in the ancient literature, were looked at as the beautiful things, beautiful object to just ponder upon and then just write about her beauty. And expecting her to be so submissive, doing everything by the permission of men or just, you know, belonging to a man.
Women in the modern and contemporary poems and literature have challenged that
mm-hmm.
traditional representation of women.
Like in past times, because the male gender were just the ones who wrote about women, they did not know her truly. Now, let's talk about the traits of women in these novels or stories and whatsoever. So ever since we just started to go for stories, and when we were kids, we heard the stories of these cruel women, and then this beautiful woman, and then this, you know, kind mother, and then this spoiled girl, and then, you know, all these sort of images that we have of a woman in our mind. I guess all of them want to show us that women have got this diversity of characteristics. They could be many things, and it depends on the society and on the background they're living in.
Exactly, and all that diversity should be portrayed.
Exactly.
Not, as you rightly mentioned, there are a lot of, you know, these diversities. So women should be portrayed in poems and literature as diverse, mm-hmm. complex, and authentic human beings who have their own voices,
exactly.
who have their own choices, who have their own stories.
And who has a brain, and she thinks, and her mind is so colorful.
Beauty with brains, you know, exactly. not only the beauty as depicted in the ancient poems. So she has beauty with brains. When it comes to being human, when it comes to creativity, when it comes to intelligence, when it comes to value, although she has these biological differences with men, but, you know, when it comes to all these things, yeah. like, you know, being human, spirituality, creativity, mm-hmm. the intelligence, here she should be depicted as good as man. There have been also in the ancient times some of the very great poets who criticized women as being treated as a second-class citizen or like
yeah, yeah.
as a mere object. Like we have this Allama Iqbal, the great poet, the philosopher, who says, you know, he wrote many poems where he praised women, their qualities, their contributions and rights. But some of the examples from his poems where he accepts, admits what kind of changes are being made mm-hmm. and how women is, you know, materialized, how she's portrayed as an object. He says that, मैं भी मज़लूम निस्वा से हूँ गमनाक बहुत नहीं मुमकिन मगर उस उक़दे मुश्किल की कुशूद. He says, I too feel sad about the oppression of women. Talks about the literary mm-hmm. world, you know. I too feel sad about the oppression of women, but this problem full of knots cannot be resolved. He does not even see the hope of being resolved because she's so much, you know, portrayed as object, submissive. Now he sees this problem as full of knots. There are ways how she can be depicted. Yeah. We're talking about the ways. Again, just since we're talking about Iqbal, so yeah, one of his poems came to my mind. It was Khizr-e-Ra, mm-hmm. the guide. So he depicts in this poem the Prophet Khizr as a guide who leads him to a wise woman, exploring for him woman's knowledge and wisdom.
Yeah. So I guess it's better for us to go for a short break and then we'll be back. Beauty. I just remembered a beautiful part of a novel by F. S. Scott Fitzgerald, who was a great writer. She was beautiful, but not like those girls in the magazines. She was beautiful for the way she thought. She was beautiful for the sparkle in her eyes when she talked about something she loved. She was beautiful for her ability to make other people smile, even if she was sad. She wasn't beautiful for something as temporary as her looks. She was beautiful deep down to her soul. She is beautiful. And yes, truly, in the old times, whatever they used to portray of a woman was just her temporary beauty. But then time changed, and then when women started to talk about themselves and write themselves in stories and novels, they changed the point of view of the entire world towards them, not just only men. Yeah, so this is the role of literature, to change the perspective of human beings.
The Persian poetry in itself depicts a lot of teachings of Islam, and the women who have come up with the writings, who have portrayed themselves, different characters in the Persian yeah. poetry, is in itself so amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I cannot stop myself just yeah. reciting one of the very beautiful poems of
and
my...
And such a strong woman. I just recently, some years ago, I was reading this book by a woman who lived the years of war, and then she wrote a book about what she was suffering from, everything that they lived and they went through. So the book is so beautiful and has been put in such a detail that you feel like, okay, you are living the pain just as she was going through.
Exactly. That's how women should be portraying all their sufferings, all their
exactly.
struggles, all those tough things, and depict themselves as heroes. Not only men are superheroes.
Exactly. But she was the hero of
exactly,
the story.
Exactly. But the women who are, you know, who overcome these challenges of life yeah. are actually superheroes. And they should... I think a woman is every day a superhero.
Exactly.
Who is, you know, managing a house. Mm-hmm. A housewife is every day a superhero. Women.
And in our Islamic heritage, we have these true, real heroines that just act like the role models for Muslim ladies, just like Lady Fatima Zahra or just Sayyida Zainab Salamullah Alayha. All of them are just the example of great Muslim women that have been a strong, knowledgeable, beautiful for the way they lived, the way they thought, and all the things that they have been teaching us.
If talking about the history, I think we can take a very good example of Umm al-Baneen.
Exactly.
She was a yeah. very good literary person, and we even have those narratives of Karbala because of her. Many of those we have because of her, how beautifully she, in an artistic way, mm-hmm. She explored them all. Well, even today, the contemporary women in Iran, I have one of the friends whose name is Razia Jabehtari, who is a very beautiful poet and has, you know, explained the way a woman should be depicted or portrayed in the poems. I would like read out one of her Persian poems as we went through the English ones. We went through the Iqbal, and now there's another poem like by this Persian poem by Sister Razia, who says that, I sit and talk to myself quietly until the morning. I recite poetry in those uncertain hours until the morning. Like Rumi, Sadi, Nizami tell me stories, and I have philosophical discussions with Khayyam until morning. Having, you know, depicting the intellectual part of a woman. In the mornings, I'm a mother busy with the household chores until night. I weave poetry from the hair of my daughter's hair until the morning.
The morning.
Clean the dishes, engage in the zikr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and then remembrance with all these inspirations. I become a prophet until the morning. I count the beads and then ask for forgiveness at night. I get out of my own skin to to grab that pilgrimage until the morning. Night after night, I'm waiting for to see the sun. She means from sun, Imam Mahdi, ajallahu ta'ala faraja. I only stay alive with the anticipation of those days until morning.
Yeah. So thank you for staying with us. Read as much as stories and poems as you can, because these are the beautiful things that would add to your knowledge as well. So thank you, Muslim ladies, for staying with us until another session. I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us ponder on an aphorism from Imam Musa Kazim, peace be upon him, the seventh infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. the best kind of almsgiving is to help the weak.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
We are a history of siege. We are a history of uncertainty. Because we have one common problem. Spain. And we had a previous common problem, UK.
A strip of sea, a strip of land surrounded by water. The last European frontier separating Spain from the United Kingdom. The border is a mere few hundred meters long. It is the shortest border in the world and separates the Spanish city called La Línea de la Concepción from Gibraltar, a British colony. It's the last colony in Europe, as well as the smallest territory among those included in the UN official list of countries to decolonize. Since 1713, Gibraltar has been the center of a diplomatic war which doesn't allow its inhabitants to decide their own future.
The history of Gibraltar really starts with the War of Succession, and in fact the British and the Dutch arrive to recover Gibraltar for Spain. They're not technically getting it for themselves, but typically of the British and the start of their major colonial expansion, as soon as they got here and they saw the naval strategic position, they basically decided to keep it. And then the history becomes a colonial history. Of course, Spain all the time is trying to recover, but doesn't have the military strength to do that.
It is almost a diplomatic or a political dispute. I would not like to use the word war, but it's a dispute that there is between England and or the United Kingdom, I should say, and Spain over a very small place that is Gibraltar. If one goes to New York, the United Nations headquarters, and looks at the list of colonies, Gibraltar is there. And Gibraltar is in the agenda as an issue to be resolved, as a colony to be decolonized. That doesn't mean we necessarily agree with the United Nations interpretation of Gibraltar's status. The fact that the United Nations considers us to be a colony does not necessarily mean that we agree that we are a colony.
Gibraltar is the gateway between Africa and Europe. It is known as the Rock, and its strategic position is the key issue in the Spanish-British dispute. Provocations and complaints are the ingredients that have caused a political chill that has increased over recent years, involving the citizens of both countries. Spain's strategic weapon is the border. A few hundred meters, with two different sets of armed forces, two flags, and two barriers to get through, day and night.
There are about 6,000 Spanish workers who come in, and quite a lot who are not formal workers. They're people who do the garden or they babysit and all that. But it's not a phenomenon that I'm particularly aware of. What I am aware of is that the gaming companies do employ people from all over the world because you have to speak Chinese or Arabic or whatever, and those skills, you don't get them easily locally. So that's who comes in from other countries. But that's really it, you know, that's the biggest impact in terms of work. The problem, I think, for Spanish workers is the tax, the less jobs that there are, the fact that the problems Spain introduced has led to some businesses reducing or closing, because if tourism is down and shops are getting less clients, the first thing they do is reduce the staff.
The dispute between the United Kingdom and Spain seems endless. Blocks of concrete in the sea have been the answer to the arbitrary use of border controls. Limitations in the use of Spanish workers have been the answer to the accusations of smuggling. The Spanish government accuses Gibraltar of being a tax haven. Gibraltar simply points out its British sovereignty, which is unquestionable. This is a daily, continual duel. There seems to be no solution.
Spain says insistently that, in fact, it says much worse than we are an offshore paradise. It says that we are a bunch of pirates and that everything in Gibraltar is about money laundering and other issues. So there are other countries out there, small countries, large countries, which have a very different finance system to the one we have, and they are also prospering very well because they don't have to worry like we do. In spite of being very small and in spite of having limited resources, we comply with every single European directive. We have transposed into our legislation every single European directive. The OECD, the organization that looks into these things, having given Gibraltar a B-plus rating, which is an extremely high rating, and it's an identical rating to countries like Germany and England have got. So we're also whitelisted by the International Monetary Fund. I think that these associations would not give us those magnificent ratings if we really were anything of the many things that our Spanish neighbors say we are.
To a great degree, Gibraltar has done well economically despite the UK. Because we're small, and again, because we invested in education, and because we're in the EU, all the issues that 15 years ago were presented as problems, OECD, IMF controls, tax regulation, all those things, that even here were seen as problems when they started, actually have been good for us. It's almost really a bit like somebody saying to you, you've got to lose weight, you've got to go on a diet. When you actually do it, you come out better. Margaret Thatcher closed the military base and said, your future is tourism and financial services. And that's what we did. It's not something we invented, it was a British invention. Don't forget again, who invented the finance center? Who invented Gibraltar, the Cayman Islands, Jersey, Guernsey, all the key places, Hong Kong? It was the British. I mean, they can't be against it because London is still one of the biggest. It's the mother of all finance centers. You know, I think if people are paying their tax, it's a proper legitimate business, if it's properly run, if it meets all the international standards, that's what it is.
The Salvador Nation for Gibraltar Group is a group that started in Gibraltar many years ago, over 20 years ago now, and it is a group that came about as a result of local Gibraltarian persons being worried that the rights of the Gibraltarians were perhaps not being respected. One has to see the context of the time that in which this happened. It was at a time when England and Spain were being told by the United Nations that they had to resolve the issue of Gibraltar bilaterally as between themselves. And there was therefore a sentiment amongst the people of Gibraltar that our wishes, our aspirations, and indeed our rights as a people were not being taken into consideration. We feel that with the constitution that Gibraltar adopted in 2006, Gibraltar has achieved a level of self-government as ought not to be a colony. The United Nations, however, has not decolonized us yet. The Committee of 24 and the Fourth Committee continue to consider Gibraltar a colony, and they continue to consider our issue twice a year, every year. And we have, in fact, said to them 6 years ago now that if our constitution does not do enough, if they feel that there is something more that we need to do in order to be able to be decolonized, please tell us, and we will try our utmost to do whatever it is you ask of us.
I think democracy, you know, is the most important factor, and the assertion of self-determination should be unnecessary. But the reality of our life is that it's not. I think that, you know, you shouldn't have to tell the world that you have a basic human right. You should have it. But if someone is trying to take that from you, then it becomes important to assert it. And in that respect, I think you can argue that an assertion of self-determination does not have to amount to a call for independence. It just needs to be that someone respects what you said.
We have not even been able to explore what the tailor-made solution for Gibraltar might be, because the Spanish government says that we don't have a right to choose because we're not even a people, and because the United Nations says that the issue of Gibraltar's decolonization has to be bilaterally agreed between the UK and Spain. And because of that, the people of Gibraltar have never really been given a say. Over the years, what we have done is carry out several referenda, but they have not been on what we wish to be going forward, but simply on whether we wanted to retain certain sovereignty links with the UK. And the people of Gibraltar, on the two occasions that we have had those referenda, have voted overwhelmingly in favour of remaining British and remaining and not having any joint sovereignty with Spain.
Macaque monkeys are the actual owners of Gibraltar, those who have held sovereignty since time immemorial. Not even incursions by the Moors, the Spanish, or the British, nor their conflicts have managed to get rid of them. It's been a steady and lasting domination which observes the political dispute from upon high, inaccessible chasms. In 1942, Winston Churchill, the British Prime Minister, fearing that they would become extinct, asked for more specimens to be brought from Morocco. His decision was influenced by the popular legend that is still quoted everywhere on the rock. As long as the macaques live there, Gibraltar will remain a British colony.
We are a colony, that's the problem. what we like to be is, I think, the more pertinent question. We have not even been allowed to conduct a referendum or a consultation of the type that would allow the people of Gibraltar to actually say what they want to be. England and Spain continue to have a political dispute vis-a-vis Gibraltar. Unfortunately, not always have the wishes of the people of Gibraltar been taken into consideration in that dispute.
Britain has learnt one lesson, that we might be very small, but just as Spain sees us as a stone in their shoe, we can be a little rock in the British shoe as well. It's best to leave us alone.
today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers, dear sisters, Salamun Alaikum, and welcome to this episode of today's special from IRIB English Radio. You're listening to us from Iran. We're going to speak about comparison of this life and hereafter.
I pray to God, my heart, soul, and body, every single day of my life, with every breath, I solemnly promise to try to live my life for you. Oh Allah, you did revive my soul and shone your light into my heart. So please leave you, is now my only goal. Oh, I love you so, I love you so, I love you so.
But first we look at the calendar. Today, Wednesday, 13th of the month of Safar, 1445 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 8th of Shahrivar, 1402 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and 30th of August, 2023 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. Let's listen to Allah's words. For today, verse 32 of chapter Al-An'am.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Wa mal hayatud dunya illa la'ibun wa lahw. Wa lad-darul akhiratu khayrun lil-ladhina yattaqun. Afala ta'qilun.
And the worldly life is not but amusement and diversion, but the home of the hereafter is best for those who fear Allah. So will you not reason?
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
If the life of this world does not be considered as a field for the coming world, it becomes a toy, and human beings will be busy, as children will, with playthings such as property, position, and so on. Their status can be resembled to the scene of the theater, where a person appears in the guise of a king, another one plays in the function of a servant, and the third one becomes a minister therein. After some while, all the clothing and functions will be set aside, and these persons actually find out that it has been only a play, or a film wherein they had a role of playing.
My life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong, in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
In this episode, we're speaking about comparison of this life and the hereafter. It is narrated, the most privileged people in the world from the people of the hereafter will come on the day of resurrection to be dipped into the hellfire. Then it will be said, O son of Adam, did you see any good? Did you get any blessing? He will say, "No, by Allah, my Lord," then the most miserable person, people in the world from the people of paradise will come on the day of resurrection to be dipped in the paradise. Then it will be said, "O son of Adam, did you see any hardship? Did you have any distress?" He will say, "No, by Allah, my Lord, I did not once see hardship or distress." The person who endured the most hardship for the sake of Allah will soon forget all of his pain and suffering after he is dipped into paradise, only for a moment. In contrast, the person who had the most pleasure in the world for the sake of himself will soon forget all of his happiness after he is dipped into hellfire for only a moment.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, in this session we shall be talking about this world and the hereafter and how we can achieve the excess of both worlds, this world and the hereafter. The next point that we want to refer to about the relationship between this world and the hereafter and how can we achieve the success of both worlds is to focus and pay attention to wealth versus poverty or asceticism. Are we against wealth or are we for asceticism? Let's talk about it a bit. A question comes to mind. Does not Islam, like other religions, prefer poverty to wealth and affluence? The reality is that Islam does not consider poverty or affluence as the goal. The ultimate goal is submission to the will of God, and whatever helps that submission is preferred. Therefore, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, "Wealth which prevents you from injustice is better than poverty which pushes you towards sin." So what does Islam say about asceticism or zuhd? Imam Ja'far Sadiq alayhi salam explains the real meaning of asceticism in this way. Asceticism or zuhd in this world is neither neglecting your wealth nor making the permissible halal things into forbidden or haram. Instead, zuhd in this world means that your wealth should not be stronger to you in attachment than what is with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Reflecting on different Islamic topics, short commentary of the Holy Quran, hadiths of the Infallibles, lessons from the life of the Infallibles, all in today's special from IRIB English Radio.
On this part, we'll look at one tip on how to focus on the hereafter. Start living as a stranger. We all know this, but in a real life, many of us are in denial. However, we are moving. We are on a train going to a final destination. And we have three stations, and one has already passed your time in the womb. You came into this world, the second stop is your life in this world, and third station is the everlasting station of the hereafter. The Messenger of Allah said, "Be in the world as if you were a stranger or a traveler along the path. If you survive till late afternoon, do not expect to be alive in the morning. If you survive till morning, do not expect to be alive in the late afternoon. Take from your health before your sickness and your life before your death."
Yeah.
is the price we pay for not giving this life its due share? However, we do have to give this life its due share. We have to live it. We cannot escape from it, nor can we ignore the real challenges it poses. We see from the life of the Prophet that he was an active and successful merchant before being chosen as a prophet. During his life of prophethood, he had family and dealt with worldly affairs like any fully engaged human being. We too are supposed to lead life utilizing all the resources Allah Most Glorious has bestowed on us. Accordingly, we need to educate ourselves in worldly matters and to use that knowledge to lead a good life and also to be help prevent injustices and exploitation of humanity at large. The life of example of the Prophet and the infallible Imams should make it clear as to how we should engage ourselves in the activities of this life. No one should withdraw from life forgetting his responsibilities.
بَلْ تُؤْثِرُونَ الْحَيَاةَ الدُّنْيَا وَالْآخِرَةُ خَيْرٌ وَأَبْقَى. You give a preference to this lower life, whereas that one, the real life, the eternal life, خَيْرٌ, is better for you. وَأَبْقَى, an everlasting. This is not everlasting. This is not everlasting. God says in this verse, always put values first. Don't compromise your covenant with God. Don't compromise your values, your principles. Don't compromise the truth and justice. Don't compromise it, even if you lose. Because nothing in this life is more valuable than your covenant with God. Covenant that you have with God is number one. Everything else is number two and number three. So don't sacrifice this covenant that you made with God, this contract that you signed. So here in 96, وَلَا تَشْتَرُوا بِعَهْدِ اللَّهِ, in 95, وَلَا تَشْتَرُوا بِعَهْدِ اللَّهِ ثَمَنًا قَلِيلًا, إِنَّمَا عِنْدَ اللَّهِ هُوَ خَيْرٌ لَكُمْ, surely that which is with God is better for you, إِن كُنْتُمْ تَعْلَمُونَ, if you know, if you realize, if you reflect, if you think, in kuntum ta'lamun. Then the next one says, ma indakum. This is powerful, my friends. Ma indakum, indeed. Ma indakum yanfadu wa ma indallahi baq. What is with you comes to an end. But what is with God subsists, stays, does not go out.
Dear brothers and sisters, thank you very much for listening to us. That was all for today's special. Inshallah, we meet you soon on the next episode of this program tomorrow. Same channel and same time. Thank you very much and fi amanillah.
Told me that I'm crazy, who you praying for? They told me there is nothing, who you looking for? Stop doing what you're doing, cause there is no hope. Just come with me, I'll show you what's behind your door. And they showed me all kind of lies. My eyes were like, yes, I was mesmerized. But deep inside I know that there's a better world. Cause I'm a believer. I'm a believer.
comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.